Well, as we work through the story, we're getting to the part of the Old Testament that is less well known. We recently looked at the life of King David, and then 2 weeks ago, the life of his son Solomon, known for his wisdom. You might call those the glory days of Israel, when the nation was at its peak. No major wars, lots of prosperity, and faithfulness to God was paramount. But then toward the end of Solomon's reign, as he married more and more foreign women, something the Israelites were told not to do, his heart turned away from God somewhat as he built shrines and altars for the gods that his foreign wives worshiped. And the word of the Lord came to Solomon near the end of his life, saying, "Since you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of your father, of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hands of your son." Now Solomon's son, who would inherit the throne, was Rehoboam. During his reign, Solomon discovered that one of his own officials wanted to be that one who would tear the kingdom from him. His name was Jeroboam. So in today's story, we have Rehoboam versus Jeroboam. Now, it must have been the trend in those days to name your son something with Boam at the end. Add Boam to the end of your name and see what you get. I don't know about you, but I find the similar sounding names somewhat confusing. So here's how I've learned to tell them apart. And that is, in our own English language, the prefix re means again, like to redo or to repeat. And Rehoboam wanted to repeat his father Solomon in what he was doing and maybe even outdo him. And so Rehoboam intended to be a repeat. Now his rival Jeroboam was the official under Solomon in charge of the labor force for the king. Now he must have been a good boss because apparently the people liked him and he was fairly popular. And one day the prophet Ahijah met Jeroboam out in the country where no one else was around, and Ahijah took his new cloak and tore it into 12 pieces and then told Jeroboam, "Take 10. Now, he wasn't telling him to take a rest. He was telling him to take 10 pieces of the robe that he had just torn up. And here was his explanation. He says, "I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David in the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. I will do this because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Molech, the god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in obedience to me, nor done what is right in my eyes, or kept my decrees and laws, as David, Solomon's father, did." Now, did you notice the math doesn't quite add up? 12 tribes represented by 12 pieces of cloth. Jeroboam gets 10, and one is left for the descendants of David. Now, back when I went to school, 12 minus 10 was 2. So where's the missing tribe? Well, the missing tribe is the small tribe of Simeon, which tended to get lumped in with the larger and more prominent tribe of Judah. And so that one tribe that the prophet Ahijah refers to is Judah, but it also included the smaller tribe of Simeon. Now, we don't know that Jeroboam had aspirations to challenge Solomon as king before this word of the Lord came through Ahijah, but after this, he must have done something, we're not told what, but something that threatened Solomon, because we're told that Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam. Jeroboam escaped, he fled to Egypt, and he stayed there till Solomon died. Now, you remember back when Saul was king and David was told by God that he would become king, David waited until God brought it about. He didn't force it when he easily could have killed King Saul. But Jeroboam must have decided that he was going to make it happen himself. And it didn't work. He ended up in exile. But then after Solomon died, the people gathered at Shechem to make Rehoboam, Solomon's son, king. And Jeroboam came back from Egypt and seemed to be the spokesman for some of the people. And he went to Rehoboam and said this. He said, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us. Now lighten the harsh labor and heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." You know, Solomon had built the temple and greatly increased his own wealth. And some of it came from foreign countries, but a lot came from taxes and from people being conscripted to do the labor. And so the people were asking, "Can you give us a break? Lighten it up a little bit." Now, this should sound familiar to us too, shouldn't it? You know, we ask our politicians, you know, "Are you going to raise my taxes or are you going to lower them?" Well, King Rehoboam said, "Give me 3 days to come up with an answer." And he did the smart thing. He consulted some other people. And first he asked the elders who had served his father, and they said, "If today you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants." But apparently that wasn't the answer he wanted, because he rejected it even before he got another opinion. And next he went to the young men that he had grown up with, and this was their answer. "Tell the people, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid a heavy yoke on you. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." Well, that's the answer Rehoboam wanted, and that's the one he took to the people. And when the people heard this harsh response, they said, "What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your own tents, Israel. Look after your own house, David." And so 10 of the tribes went home, made Jeroboam their king, and Rehoboam was left with the tribe of Judah, which, as we said, also included Simeon. And since Judah was David's tribe, they felt a greater loyalty to his grandson, Rehoboam. So the 10 tribes became known as the Northern Kingdom, hereafter called simply Israel. And Judah, with Simeon, became known as the Southern Kingdom, or more simply, Judah or Judea. Now, up to this point, Israel referred to the whole, you know, all 12 tribes, but after this split, now Israel will refer to the 10 northern tribes, and Judah will refer to the 2 southern tribes. Well, at first, Rehoboam put together an army and wanted to force the 10 northern tribes to return to his control. It would have been a civil war, and we know how those go. But God intervened and said, "Don't fight against your brothers. Go home, every one of you, for this is my doing." And so they did go home. They went home. But sometimes there were skirmishes between the 2 groups, the 2 kingdoms. Now, King Jeroboam in the northern kingdom, realized there was a problem. Jerusalem, the center of worship and where the temple was in Judah. And he knew that if the people went back there regularly to worship and to sacrifice, their loyalty might swing back to Rehoboam. And so here's what he did. He made 2 golden calves, set one up in Bethel and the other one in Dan, and said to the people, "Here are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt." Where have we heard this before? God was not pleased. Another thing Jeroboam did was to appoint anyone who wanted to be a priest to be a priest. You know, before this, you had to belong to the tribe of Levi, which remained the case in Judah. Well, as time went on, there was a succession of kings, both in the northern and southern kingdoms, and most of the kings were judged as bad because they allowed idol worship or even promoted the worship of other gods. The few who were judged as good kings were the ones who called Israel or Judah back to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and got rid of altars to the other gods. Well, that's kind of a summary of the story that we're covering today. But I'd like to go back and take a closer look at the choice Rehoboam was given when he became king. The choice to ease up or to make things harder on the people. You know, the elders who had served his father Solomon advised him, if today you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants. It's interesting that they advised Rehoboam to be a servant to the people. Back in 1970, a man by the name of Robert Greenleaf wrote an essay titled, The Servant as Leader. It got a lot of attention, and out of it came the term servant leadership. Now, Greenleaf was not advocating servant leadership from a Christian perspective. He was addressing mainly the business world. But many Christians said, this sounds a lot like Jesus and how Christians are supposed to act. Servant leaders share their power. They focus on the needs of others and have a goal of helping people grow and develop. And a key question, according to Greenleaf, is, are those who are being led becoming healthier, wiser, freer, more autonomous, and more likely themselves to become servants? Servant leadership is in contrast to leaders who use their power to promote themselves, or leaders who step on other people to get ahead or to use people for their own gain. In today's world, we have leaders like King Assad of Syria, who's willing to use chemical weapons to kill his own people to keep his hold on power. And there are other countries where there are dictators who, instead of tending to the needs of their people, are stashing away millions of dollars in foreign bank accounts, knowing that someday they may get run out of their country, and then they can find asylum in another country and live out their days with their stolen wealth. Or consider our own President Johnson during the Vietnam War, when it became clear that we weren't going to win the war, said privately at the time, I'm not going to be the first U.S. president to lose a war. And so he just kept the war going, and thousands of men lost their lives, or were physically or mentally wounded, so he wouldn't have a stain on his record. Now, in contrast to that attitude, consider the new president of Mexico sworn in last month, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, known by his initials AMLO. He said, I don't need a presidential palace to live in. Let's open it to the public and make it a museum. He got rid of the presidential jet, saying he could fly economy on commercial flights. He replaced the presidential secret service with 20 unarmed citizens representing a cross-section of Mexican society. He said, I don't want to be fenced off from the people. And one of his major goals is to lift up the poor in Mexico. Just a few examples, and we see it in our own world. Politicians who some see their position as a way of power to enrich and promote themselves, whereas others see their position of power as a way to serve and to help others. And here is how Jesus made that contrast in Luke 22, 25 to 27. Jesus said, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. Jesus saw himself as a servant leader and calls us to do the same. Jesus exercised leadership and authority, but he did it to help others. And Jesus healed people, he forgave them, He cast out demons and set people free. He taught them the ways of God so that they would know the truth. He passed on authority to his disciples so they could do the ministry that he was doing. He used his authority to lift up women and children and outcasts. He absorbed ridicule and abuse because he attended to sinners and those with bad reputations. He washed his disciples' feet because no job was beneath him. Jesus said, "I am among you as one who serves." Now, it's important to note that just because we take the role of a servant does not mean that we do whatever someone else tells us to do. You know, when we think of a servant, we think of someone who's told what to do by somebody else. But that's not the case with what we're talking about here. Jesus chose to serve, but he didn't just do what other people told him to do. He decided himself when and how he would serve. You know, the people wanted to make him a king like David, and he said no. Some wanted him to stop talking about dying and being crucified, and Jesus said no. Some wanted him to quit healing on the Sabbath, and he said no. You know, Jesus chose when and how he would serve. He didn't just do what others told him to do. There are many times he responded to requests, but he always reserved the right to decide if this was a good thing to do. And the same is true for us. We choose to serve, but we don't give others the right to boss us around. We still have the responsibility to decide what is the right and appropriate thing to do. Well, maybe you think servant leadership just applies to politicians and bosses and church leaders, but it actually applies to most of us, even to parents and spouses. If you are a parent, are you a servant leader? Are you focused on helping your children become the persons God created them to be, according to their strengths and talents, or even God's call on their lives? You know, in contrast, as a parent who pushes their child to play a certain sport or instrument because it makes the parent look good, or to pursue a prestigious occupation rather than what the child is really interested in doing or is gifted for. And some parents are so controlling that their children never learn how to make decisions themselves or to develop a healthy self-confidence. And then there's the other extreme, the parents who are literally a servant to their child who's allowed to boss them around. You've probably seen some of those, you know, the parent who does what the child says. And that's not good or healthy either. When you are a servant leader, you're still in charge, but you use your power and your position as a parent to help your child grow and develop in healthy ways and to become the person God created them to be. And this also applies to marriage and to spouses. Some husbands think they have the right to boss their wives around. And some wives think they have the right to boss their husbands. Bossing someone else around is never healthy for either person. In a Christ-centered marriage, both persons give themselves in service to the other. Each is trying to help the other reach their potential and is seeking their good. In Ephesians 5, the Apostle Paul tells husbands to love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. And so there's no better place to practice servant leadership than in your marriage and in your home. But unfortunately, some marriages end up in a split, like Israel split, because one or both spouses are like Rehoboam and decide to be demanding rather than serving. But back to Rehoboam in the Old Testament, you know, he rejected the servant approach to leadership and decided instead to rule harshly. And because of that decision, he lost most of the kingdom. You know, God had warned the people about this back when they first asked for a king. And at that time, Samuel was a judge, and Samuel said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and to reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. And when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." If we fast forward in the story, and we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but if looking ahead to the time, there's a time when the Lord spoke through the prophet Ezekiel, where he condemned leaders like Rehoboam, and who in this passage he refers to them as shepherds. And Ezekiel says, "This is what the sovereign Lord says: Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays, or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally." And then in Ezekiel, God announced his solution to deal with shepherds like Rehoboam. God says, "I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord. I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak. But the sleek and the strong I will destroy. I will shepherd the flock with justice." Well, how is God going to pull this off? How will God shepherd his sheep himself? Well, we eventually find out. Spoiler alert here. God came in the person of Jesus, who announced, "I am the good shepherd." Jesus came as a servant leader who cared for his sheep, even laying down his life for them. Would you join me in prayer? Jesus, we proclaim you as our Lord and King, and yet we're amazed that you came into this world and chose to serve others, to be a servant, that even though you exercised power and authority, you did it on behalf of others to help them, to lift them up. And so we're amazed at your goodness, and we're glad to call you our shepherd and our King. And help us to follow in your example, follow in your ways, to also take the role of a servant, seeking to do what is good and helpful for others. And may you give us the strength. It's in your name we pray. Amen.